This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
The Barbican is utopian in a way that nowhere else I know in Britain really is. Quite often when I give talks about my work to students, I start with a picture of the Barbican because it was built in the 60s. It has that, you know, design can make the world a better place feel about it.
It's 50 years since the first residents moved into London's Barbican estate. We visit the much-discussed brutalist housing complex to find out what all the cooing is about. Plus...
National Museum wanted to show a larger part of its collection, which covers Swedish and international art from six centuries.
Sweden's National Museum opens after a major five-year facelift. Our Stockholm correspondent takes us on a tour and asks what part design can play in building a national narrative. All that and plenty more besides coming up right here on Monocle on Design with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. It's been a full half century since the first wave of residents moved into the curious, poured concrete creation of architects Chamberlain, Powell and Bonn. We're talking, of course, about the Barbican Estate in London. Like it or loathe it, there's a good chance you know exactly the building we're talking about. Although initially decried during its construction from the 1960s to the 1980s, the project has become a backdrop for films, photo shoots and countless books about brutalism, and remains popular with design-minded residents. Designer and writer Steffi Orazzi has penned a rather beautiful new book entitled The Barbican Estate, which was published earlier this month by Pavilion. The subject, where the nooks, crannies and 100 or so different apartment types within the building, of course. Monocle's Daphne Karnesis met with Orazzi to talk about the highs and lows of life at the Barbican.
The initial idea sort of just came about through a conversation with my friend that we were playing like, what's your favourite Barbican flat type? And there is a website that somebody that lives in the Barbican's put together called Barbican Living, and he scanned all the original plans. So you can access these plans on the website. And I'd said to my friend, well, it's a shame that there isn't a book that has all these plans. And I was like, oh, maybe I could do that book. So that was one of the reasons. And another one was that when I did my first book, Modernist Estates, a former Barbican resident emailed me and said, I was one of the first residents to move in. We wanted a flat in such and such a tower, but we couldn't afford that one. We moved to Seddon House and the theatre was just getting built. And it was just such a lovely story. And it just made me think these sort of need to be captured.
And just touching on what you said before about someone saying, oh, I wanted to live in this tower block, but I couldn't afford it. Do you think that you can sense a bit of that here at the Barbican? Some kind of reflection of class or social status depending on which part of the Barbican you live in?
When you move in here, you very quickly sort of realise like, oh yes, but that aspect is probably better than that aspect. I think one of the first questions, if somebody says, I live in a tower, you know, the next question is, what floor? So there is a sort of hierarchy. And I think a lot of people do move from one flat to another. I think you stay in one and you realise like, actually, I think that would suit me better. But I don't know if there's a real hierarchy.
One of the overarching feelings that I have when I visit is that I'm kind of in awe of the scale of the place. Is there a more human scale, though?
I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do the book, because I think the architecture as a visitor is so overwhelming that it's sort of really dominant and people just see the concrete and then brutalist architecture. I'm so used to the outside that I don't even think about the fact that it's concrete. I mean, one of the original designs was to clad the whole of the Barbican in marble. So it wasn't really one of the first concepts that they were thinking, like, we want to have this sort of brutalist structure. And so for me, it really was, because people talk about it in that respect, that I wanted to focus in on the design of the flats and the different typologies. And as soon as you're inside, you kind of forget about what it's made out of.
And can you just describe to our listeners where we are now and why you picked this spot to start our tour?
Okay. Well, I call them igloos, although thinking about it, I don't know if they're actually called igloos. They might be called pods. And it's essentially part of the residence-only gardens. And ahead of us is the waterfall. And you access these pods by crossing a little bridge that goes across the lake. I think one of the things about any Barbican residence, they'll tell you that they need this special key, and the special key gives you access to all the residence gardens. So we're in one of those areas now. I think obviously area has so much to do with it. I mean, we're in the centre of London, and also the maintenance here is sort of fantastic. The service charges are quite expensive, but everyone is very, very willing to pay for them because you get so much for them. You know, like all the gardens are really immaculate. Everything's swept. You'll get concierge. It's just, you know, it's expensive to run housing like this. It's expensive to run any kind of housing. And I think the thing with a lot of social housing is after they were built, they were neglected. And as soon as, you know, something starts to get neglected, people start to lack any kind of care for it, and it's a sort of bit of a downward spiral. And that hasn't happened here because they keep pumping money into it and making sure that it's all very well run and kept as it should be. One of the biggest changes over the years is that a lot of the 1960s buildings that were built around the similar time of the Barbican have been demolished to make way for new buildings. And I think the Barbican sort of feels like an island in that it's getting very built up around it. For example, one of the biggest things was one of the first buildings to be built that was initially but not officially part of the Barbican was Milton Court. And it was a very Le Corbusian building. It was a beautiful building and it had a fire brigade stationed there and it also had residential. And that was demolished, I think, in 2001. And it wasn't listed as part of the estate, which was kind of shocking. It never quite made sense why it wasn't. And instead of that, they knocked it down, built the new part of the Guildhall School of Music, but also these very sort of tall, modern tower called the Heron Tower, I think it's called. So that is sort of happening all the way around the Barbican. So that's, I would say, that's one of a lot of the sort of connecting pedways and walkways that would have connected the buildings have now being demolished. So whereas before you could walk from here to St. Paul's on a raised pedway, and now they've been demolished. So another thing when people say they get lost is because now you have to go up and down and up and down to get to the various levels. But the initial concept is that you could walk around on this elevated level, and initially the idea was that you would be able to walk around the whole of the city and a lot of London across these sort of elevated pedways.
Through your research, is there anything new or surprising that you found out that you didn't already know?
I interviewed a guy who grew up here. So his parents moved here before he was born. And so I think he was pretty much born here. So that was mid-70s, I think. And he said that apart from the fact there were hardly any other children, he said that actually these gardens that we're in now, they weren't gated and actually anybody could wander in, which kind of fits the whole much more sort of open utopian feeling that the architects had envisaged. I don't think they necessarily wanted a gated community. They imagined it to be much more open.
What would be your favourite features of the estate?
Whether it's concrete or not, I think one of the fantastic things about the Barbican is that there are so many typologies. There are so many different levels and buildings and heights that it's not monotonous. I think the fact that the buildings are raised, so everybody has an elevated view, so you go into your flat and you're higher, it sort of lifts you up, literally. I think it works really well, mainly because there are so many typologies, from studio flats to full-story houses. And I think the thing about that is as soon as you have those typologies, you get different people living here. And I think that's part of the success of it.
Can you give us a few examples of some of the typologies and just a broad brushstroke overview?
Well, I can tell you my favourites. There's three towers, and the rest of them are... then there's terrace blocks, which make up the majority of the estate. And then there are also some houses, which are quite unique. So there's Wallside and the Postern, and they're sort of family houses, four-storey family houses.
I guess there's not many of those.
There's not that many of them. They're super beautiful. But the majority of the blocks are in the terrace blocks, and they start from tiny studios. And the most common layout is a sort of two-bedroom flat. And then more interesting things start to happen, which make up the sort of middle of the blocks, I suppose. And then more interesting things happen sort of below podium, so where we're looking at now, which is everything below podium is brick as opposed to concrete. That's essentially the premise of the whole of the estate. So interesting things happen then. So the flats that we're looking at have a sort of U-shaped window and double height living area, and they're sort of split level flats, so there's a sort of split level up into the dining area, and they also have gardens at the back. So this is one of the flats that I used to live in, so that's quite unusual. And then at the top, again, more interesting things happen because they have this barrel vault, so it sort of mirrors the U-shape but the other way around, and they have this double height space with this great big sort of barrel ceiling. And in terms of my very, very favourite flat, so there's a block called John Trundle Court, which is mainly made up of studio flats. But at the very top, there's a duplex apartment with a spiral staircase, and the top floor is just one massive bedroom with a barrel vault. I forget the flat type, but it's in my book, and I think that's sort of an amazing one-bedroom flat.
So how many types are there overall?
There's in total about 140 variations, but within that, a lot of them are very, very similar. There might be just a cupboard that's slightly different. I would say, fundamentally, there's probably about 30 very, very different flat types, and that's what we tried to capture in the book, that we only photographed the ones that were very different from each other.
Steffi Urazzi, author of The Barbican Estate there, speaking to this show's producer, Daphne Karnesis, at the Barbican Estate, of all places. Stay tuned for part two of that report, where we'll be speaking to a resident of the estate. But first, we're off to Sweden. What clues do buildings give about the reasons that they're built in the first place? For the same reason that church spires soar and create visible landmarks for the faithful, and palaces push agendas of wealth and power, a lot of thought goes into what public buildings say about a city, or even the state that they occupy. And so it is with Sweden's National Museum, which reopened in October 2018 after a major five-year revamp. The early 19th century pile has been upgraded in more ways than one. The windows have been widened to allow more natural light in, and the original scheme of bold colours has been reinstated in the exhibition rooms. But some of the biggest changes lie beneath the surface. Our correspondent in Stockholm, Elna Nykänen-Andersson, takes us on a tour of the new museum and asks us what all these design-minded interventions say about the Swedishness of the new building.
After 5 years of renovation, rebuilding and restoration, Sweden's National Museum has opened its doors again. What has changed? Almost everything, it seems. The building itself, originally opened in 1866, still stands opposite to the Royal Castle on the Blasieholmen Peninsula, but after thorough studies, planning and years of hard work, everything from its layout to the colours of the interior and the contents of the exhibitions is new. Stepping into Stockholm's oldest and now newest museum is to treat yourself to a series of wow moments. The previously murky and labyrinthine space has been replaced by a welcoming and open museum where natural light flows in from huge windows that have been opened up, having been covered since the 1930s to protect the art. Now, thanks to modern technology which filters out the damaging rays of sun, visitors can yet again enjoy beautiful views over Stockholm's waters. The galleries, previously white, now shine in pink, green, yellow and many more colours, a return to the rich presentation style the museum had when it originally opened. Curator Helena Kåberg took monocle for a tour of the museum and explained that the colour scheme was inspired by the design of the building's original architect, Friedrich Stühler.
The inspiration came from Stühler's original watercolours, which were very striking. We have yellow, pink, purple, green, blue, whatever, very strong. He created the concept for the museum in the 1840s, and the color scheme was finished in the early 1860s, but he didn't finish it, so another architect took over and sort of toned it down. But we have gone back to the original idea to use strong colors. But it's not a recreation of the Stühler. It's also sort of a modernized, kind of tweaked color scheme, because the idea is also to make this a contemporary experience for us today and not a 19th century experience.
Swedes are famous for their love of consensus and collaboration, and in true Swedish fashion, the museum's new design is the result of teamwork. Three architect offices have worked on the building. Swedish Vingårds and Wikerstål Arkitekter took care of the restoration and upgrade of the building itself, while Joel Sanders from the US designed a display system for the art with podiums, vitrines and freestanding wall systems. The museum's new restaurant features original, specially commissioned objects from Sweden's leading contemporary designers. Today, the museum feels very natural in its new guise, but getting there took years of detailed architectural work. Architect Gert Wingård and his colleague Josefin Larsson explain what the biggest challenges were.
To fit all these modern installations and technique into a 19th century building. The building was not made like this at all. I mean, there was barely any technical installations. There were no cloakrooms, for instance, and no toilets, no accessibility for wheelchairs or prams or anything like that. In our modern society, that's something that we have to see to.
We do have to have a stable climate in the building, because we do have some of the best artwork ever produced in Sweden, and there is international artwork like Rembrandt and so forth. Usually when you take like an office building, which is not that big an issue with climate, you usually spend about 7 to 10% of the net square footage of the building on mechanical plant rooms. And there were none in this building. And we do have to have a more advanced, it might be like 15% or something on the total gross square. So where do we find that? Do we block off an entire story? Or we eventually discovered the two courtyards that we could dig deeper into the peninsula and find the proper space underneath the two courtyards.
The museum has many ingenious technical solutions, like the rose-formed decorations in the ceilings, which hide ventilation and sprinklers. All the ductwork has been hidden in the floors between the first and second stories. An elevator has been installed in order to make the museum more accessible. It was very important for the museum to welcome everyone, people of all ages and from all groups in society. The permanent collections are also free to visit.
One of the things that we were told by the client when we came in that they wished to do was to get light into the museum. They wanted us to open up the two inner courtyards. One of them was already built in, it was a restaurant before. And the other one has been filled with an auditorium and some exhibition space since the 1950s. And we decided to take it all out to get the light in. And then we got these two big free spaces. And it was also a wish from the museum to add this kind of surfaces to not only show paintings on the walls in this museum, but to have a more flexible space where you can have installations or music, a more public living room for the city.
As a result of the renovation, the museum can now accommodate twice as many visitors. The exhibition space has increased by 30% thanks to a decision to move storage and office spaces to a different site. National Museum wanted to show a larger part of its collection, which covers Swedish and international art from six centuries. Creating enough wall space for the collections was a difficult task, which architect Joel Sanders was asked to look into.
This is when I went like, you got to be kidding, right? Because we're in a room. This room was designed to be a library, not a gallery. There's no wall surface. And then they said, we're actually taking more walls away because we have to open up the windows for natural light. How do we do it? And respect the architecture. So what we came up with together was, I call it a kit of parts. It's a system that consists of walls, platforms, labels, vitrines, and podiums that could be deployed throughout the museum systematically to show this work.
Thanks to Sanders, a flexible display system, which is used to divide the museum's massive rooms into smaller compartments, National Museum manages to be both grand and cozy at the same time. The art hangs tightly like it would in a person's home, and different media, from paintings to furniture and other design objects, are mixed within the same room. Helena Kåberg explains the thinking behind these thematic exhibitions.
We have
stopped this idea to show art in national schools. We used to have a French gallery, a Swedish gallery, a Dutch gallery, and of course paintings upstairs and decorative arts on this floor. Now where this room particular is about the modern city, it's about the art scene in Paris at the turn of the century, 1900. So we're not showing just French artists, we're showing artists from Sweden and Denmark and Norway and Finland who were also part of this art scene. So that's also a new way of integrating and also showing that art is global and that there was international cooperation.
In many ways, the museum makes a subtle political point that feels timely in a country where the extreme right just won close to 20% in the parliament. Some exhibitions make this point very clearly.
In this particular display, we also have a theme that has to do with emigration. We were creating this display during when all the refugees came from Syria to Sweden and the rest of Europe. So we wanted to talk about other people who had emigrated in similar fashion and became successful designers. So we picked, for example, Arno Jakobsen's print with the green things that you find along the simple road in Sweden. He was of Jewish heritage and he fled Denmark during the German occupation and worked as a textile designer in Sweden during the war.
So what does Sweden's National Museum say about the country and the people it represents? Here, multiculturalism is presented as the natural part of Sweden it has always been. Everyone is welcome, a fact made easier by the building's modern technology and the last government's decision to abandon admission fees. It may not be the Sweden we always see, but it is the Sweden Nationalmuseum wants to achieve.
Our very special thanks to the wonderful Elna Nikkanen Andersson, our correspondent in Stockholm. Now for the second part of our special report from the Barbican Estate right here in London. Monocle's Daphne Karnesis stepped inside one of the coveted apartments of the estate's Gilbert House to speak to long-time owners about living in a near-legendary abode.
So where are we heading to now?
So we're going to head to a flat in Gilbert House. So we're just about to walk across Gilbert Bridge. And Gilbert Bridge spans the sort of central lake.
I'm Lucy Roberts and I live in the Barbican, obviously. I'm also a designer, graphic designer. When I first moved here, it must have been actually 93, I think, 92, 93. And then I lived here for about 4 years, left for a few years, really missed it and came back. The Barbican is utopian in a way that nowhere else I know in Britain really is. And also, quite often when I give talks about my work to students, I start with a picture of the Barbican because it was built in the 60s. It has that, you know, design can make the world a better place feel about it. And I was built in the 60s. and my parents were designers, and so they brought me up believing that design can make a difference. So it completely chimes with who I am on many, many levels. Okay, so this is the living room, obviously, double height. And there's one of the other lovely things about the Barbican is the way that the spaces can be subdivided. So quite often there's a sliding door, or here we've got this concertina door. So this space to the left would originally have been for a dining area, I think. We don't use it that way. So you've got a degree of privacy if you pull that across. And obviously all the Barbican flats have these fantastic sliding floor-to-ceiling glass doors, which is great. So if you once it's pulled back, there's that sort of the outdoors is indoors and vice versa thing going on, which is very typical of the period, really. And then, so if we go into the kitchen, so ours is pretty much an original kitchen. We have put in a dishwasher, which meant taking out one of the units over here on the right. But they were designed by marine builders, so they are proper galley kitchens, you know, like you'd get on a boat. So very, very clever use of space with these high up cupboards and so on. So every space is used, really. We first rented this from the Corporation of London because it was deemed to be a heritage flat because it was in pretty much original state.
So when they decided to rent it, they wanted people here who would understand the value of that. So we had to agree to do open house and things like that. That was in our contract with them. And then after a few years, we were able to buy it. That all helped so that we understood exactly why it was important, really, architecturally. I think all Barbican flat, every type has something special about it. But for us, this is perfect because it's got this double height living room, which means that the light is fantastic. And it's got three bedrooms, which is also what we needed. It's great. So it's unusually big for a Barbican flat, actually. And it's got quite a big terrace outside, big enough to have a table and chairs and, you know. So that's a lot of what makes them so fantastic. But before living here, I was living in a much smaller flat in Speed House. And that had other things that this one doesn't. So it's something that Barbican people often talk about, that there, in a way there's no perfect flat because that you might get the perfect sort of layout, but it won't be looking the right way, you know, which is kind of fair. There's a peculiarly egalitarian aspect to that, I think. I quite like the enormity of it because it makes me feel, there's something, I feel quite proud of it, really. And it's partly the scale that I think that I find it impressive. But actually, because it's orientated around two squares, effectively, with a lake in the middle, it's not that different to a Georgian square, really. And also because it looks uniform, but it isn't as uniform when you're inside the flats, which is very like a Georgian square. So I don't think of it as not being intimate. Also, I have to say, and this I shouldn't probably be quoted saying this, that the way it's orientated does encourage you to kind of look into other people's living rooms. And, you know, and you think, oh, I wonder what's going on. Especially when you know some of the people, you know. So it's actually quite intimate.
Sincere thanks to Monocle's Daphne Karnesis, reporting from the Barbican Estate in London. The book of the same name is available now from Pavilion. And sadly, that's all the time we have on this week's show. Coming up next week.
The first floor is just a work of art. And in that sense, it's a really fantastic building for me to have made. And obviously, a kind of opportunity where a lot of the artistic work that I've done for the last 25 years comes together.
We meet the Danish-Icelandic artist Olafur Eliasson to talk about his very first building project. Don't forget, if you're in mind of some design-minded inspiration, you can always delve into the pages of Monocle magazine, one of our libraries of books or many volumes of seasonal newspapers, or listen to our sister show, Monocle on Design Extra, which airs every Thursday and is available thereafter as a podcast. This show was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.